Hi, I'm David Crowe. Welcome back to The Infectious Myth. Thank you for tuning in again. This is episode 56. You can email me with comments about the show or suggestions for future guests at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs, so you can listen anytime. And remember, I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so if you send me a little message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. Today I'm live, so you can call me at 888-874-4888. If you'd like to support PRN in this or this show, please contact me. Today I don't have a guest. I'm here by myself to talk about freedom of speech. We'll start with Charlie Hebdo and move on to vaccination. Yes, freedom of speech and vaccination, there doesn't appear to be too much these days. But before I get to that, let's catch up on some feedback. Some of you may remember the name Seth Kallikman. He's a psychology professor at the University of Connecticut who, when a Texas kinesiologist wrote an article that summarized the history of dissent from the HIV-AIDS theory, he was the first person to complain to the journal that such a thing should be published. And the agreement, in order to keep Dr. Pat Goodson's article published by Frontiers in Public Health, the agreement was that Dr. Seth Kallikman would get to publish an article in opposition. And his article was really a pretty blatant attack on anybody who's dared question the HIV hypothesis, Dr. Peter Duisberg, Dr. Henry Bauer. It didn't really address any of the issues. It tried to attack the personalities of those people, what's known as an ad hominem attack. But anyway, I thought it would be really interesting to talk to Seth Kallikman on this show, so I invited him to be a guest. And he wrote back to me, "So, you are among the most destructive people I have encountered, mostly because you truly cannot see that refusing HIV treatment kills people, and not getting screened and tested for cancer kills people. I do not believe you are an evil person. That is what I learned from my experience as Joe Newton," and I'll explain that in a second. But back to his letter, "People would assume you must be evil, for you cannot possibly be serious." He meant to say serious. "But I know better. I know you are serious, not evil, not profiteering, not intentionally harming anyone, but your actions do harm people, and that you are serious is perhaps most destructive. I would really prefer not to hear back from you. Seth Kallikman, Storrs, Connecticut, USA." So I guess that's a no, and I guess Dr. Kallikman's not going to join my fan club anymore. I was hoping he would be one of the inaugural members. A couple of funny things. Well, there are a couple of things about this. The first is kind of funny. Dr. Kallikman, like a lot of people, is a little bit spelling challenged. And he, instead of writing serious, he spelled serous. And that means that someone who has serum, which is kind of interesting in the case of AIDS, because, of course, it's the serum that they use to test you HIV positive with the antibody tests. So maybe it was a little bit of a Freudian slip there. But he also mentioned the name Joe Newton. And a few years ago, Seth Kallikman, using the false name Joseph Newton, tried to, quote, infiltrate the movement of people who question the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. He really didn't need to do that because I have talked to mainstream scientists and other people from that side many times. I've never had a problem. In fact, we want to debate the issues. So we are actually pleased when people from the other side want to talk to us. Usually, people who accept the HIV-AIDS hypothesis refuse to talk to anybody who criticizes it because it's dangerous to even think about the fact that there may be problems with the HIV equals AIDS equals death hypothesis. So I think really the reason to use a false name was to create the illusion that we were some kind of secret society, that everybody who had ever questioned HIV and AIDS belonged to some nefarious underground society, which is somewhat contradictory with the fact that people who question science usually want to have a public discussion. This is not like secret meetings of neo-Nazis or something like that. But this might be the first open admission that Seth Kaufman did use the false name Joseph Newton. We did previously have evidence from his registration at a conference under a false name that was 100% clear that he had been using a false name, but now he has himself admitted that, so that's something new. More feedback is a little bit more positive from a Gary by email. Hi, if you're the guy that interviewed Thornhill, that's Wallace Thornhill from our previous episode, number 55. He goes on to say, you did a great job. I followed the Electric Universe people for years, but your interview brought out the best in Thornhill. You should do some more with him. Well, thanks, Gary, for that positive feedback. I'm glad people enjoyed the interview. There's been a couple of interviews where they're a little bit outside my comfort zone. I'm definitely not an astronomer or astrophysicist. So there's lots of areas that I'm not really that well educated on, but I did think that Wallace Thornhill brought up some really good points about our understanding of the universe and how the physics of the universe works. There are also a few things that I really couldn't get my head around. I've thought about the theories of Velikovsky before, and it seems strange to me that the solar system would have been crazily out of alignment with planets having near misses with other planets. And then more recently, everything has sedately been in its almost perfect elliptical orbit. That part seems kind of strange. But the possibility that the sun is misunderstood, that it's possibly not a fusion reaction, that it's possibly more electrical, that the origin of the universe is misunderstood, that the universe might not be expanding, that black holes might be misunderstood, those all made a lot of sense to me. So I suspect, like a lot of other scientists with brave new ideas, he's right in some areas and wrong in other areas. But my purpose was not really to... My purpose in having guests on the show is not really to endorse people and to say, whether it's Wallace Thornhill or somebody else, I'm interviewing him because he's 100% right. I'm interviewing him because I'm curious and I want to know more, and I hope that you, as my audience, are also curious. You also want to learn more. And if at the end of one of these episodes you say, gee, that made me think about X, Y, and Z, or if you're Canadian, X, Y, and Z, but he didn't convince me on A, B, and C, then I think I've done my job. And hopefully some people who are on my audience will investigate those. And if there are guests who can help fill in the gaps of knowledge, who can address some of the issues where you felt that one of my guests fell down or didn't provide enough details, I am very anxious to hear from you. And I really do like to hear from my listeners, especially when they suggest future guests. So today, let's start talking about freedom of speech again. I feel a little bit less alone on the Charlie Hebdo controversy. For those who didn't listen to my earlier episode in which I discussed this, I basically said that the opposite of being shocked and horrified by the massacre of writers and cartoonists and people who just happen to be in the building, the opposite of that is not necessarily support for Charlie Hebdo. One can deplore the cartoons of Charlie Hebdo and deplore their approach to attacking Muslims and other groups without saying that it was a good thing that they got killed. Clearly, any right-thinking person is going to be horrified by the massacre of anybody. And even if the people who got who got shot in a massacre were people I feel are despicable. It's still a massacre. It's still murder, and it's still wrong. Anyway, recently, the famous cartoonist Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury fame wrote an article, and I'd like to quote a little bit from that article about his thoughts on the Charlie Hebdo situation. First, he recites kind of an amusing and I think relevant anecdote about when he was first a cartoonist taking on some pretty hot political issues at that time. For a while, I thought we had insurmountable generational problems. That is, that he was not really going to be able to talk to the older people in society through his cartoons, and he would only be appealing to younger people. One night, after losing three papers, that is, three papers dropped his cartoons, my boss took me out for a steak and explained his strategy. The 34-year-old head of the syndicate looked at his 22-year-old discovery over the rim of his martini glass, smiled, and said, "Don't worry, sooner or later, these guys die." Well, damned if he wasn't right. A year later, the beloved patriarch of one of those three papers that dropped me passed on, leaving them to his intemperate son, whose first official act, naturally, was to restore Doonesbury. And in the years that followed, a happy pattern emerged. All across the countries, publishers who had vowed that Doonesbury would appear in their papers over their dead bodies were getting their wish. Anyway, on to Gary Trudeau's words on the Charlie Hebdo situation, which started earlier in Denmark, as he says. The Mohammed cartoon controversy began 8 years ago in Denmark as a protest against self-censorship, one editor's call to arms against what she felt was a suffocating political correctness. The idea behind the original drawings was not to entertain or enlighten or to challenge authority. Her charge to the cartoonists was specifically to provoke, and in that they were exceedingly successful. Not only was one cartoonist gunned down, but riots erupted around the world, resulting in the deaths of scores. No one could say towards what positive social end this was all occurring for, yet free speech absolutists were unchastened. Using judgment and common sense in expressing oneself was denounced as antithetical to freedom of speech. Ironically, Charlie Hebdo, which always maintained it was attacking Islamic fanatics, not the general population, has succeeded in provoking many Muslims throughout France to make common cause with its most violent outliers. This is a bitter harvest. Traditionally, satire has comforted the afflicted while afflicting the comfortable. Satire punches up against authority of all kinds, the little guy against the powerful. Great French satirists like Molière and Daumier always punched up, holding up the self-satisfied and hypocritical to ridicule. Ridiculing the non-privileged is almost never funny. It's just mean. By punching downwards, by attacking a powerless, disenfranchised minority with crude, vulgar drawings closer to graffiti than cartoons, Charlie wandered into the realm of hate speech, which in France is only illegal if it directly incites violence. Well, voila, the 7 million copies that were published following the killings did exactly that, triggering violent protests across the Muslim world, including one in Niger, in which 10 people died. Meanwhile, the French government kept busy rounding up and arresting over 100 Muslims who had foolishly used their freedom of speech to express the support of the attacks. The White House took a lot of hits for not sending a high-level representative to the pro-Charlie Solidarity March, but now that oversight is starting to look smart. The French tradition of free expression is too full of contradictions to fully embrace. Even Charlie Hebdo itself once fired a writer for not retracting an anti-Semitic column. Apparently, he crossed some red line that was in place for one minority, but not another. What free speech absolutists have failed to acknowledge is that because one has the right to offend a group does not mean that one must, or that that group gives up the right to be outraged. They're allowed to feel pain. Freedom should always be discussed within the context of responsibility. At some point, free expression absolutism becomes childish and unserious. It becomes its own kind of fanaticism. And I'll post a link to the full text of the Gary Trudeau remarks. on in the show notes. What's happened a little bit more recently, this was only Gary Trudeau's comments were early in April, and a little later this same month, there's been a serious protest within the writers' organization, PEN. PEN is giving an award to Charlie Hebdo, and a number of writers, including the famous Canadian writer Bondacci, have withdrawn from the gala, saying that they don't want to be there when Hebdo gets an award. So PEN defended themselves from this criticism from within by saying, it is undoubtedly true that in addition to provoking violent threats from extremists, the Hebdo cartoons offended some other Muslims and members of many other groups they targeted. Indeed, were the Hebdo cartoonists not satirical in their genesis and intent, their content and images might offend most or all of us. But based on their own statements, we believe that Charlie Hebdo's intent was not to ostracize or insult Muslims, but rather to reject forcefully the efforts of a small minority of radical extremists to place broad categories of speech off limits, no matter the purpose, intent, or import of the expression. The problem is that in France, there is the same deeply embedded racism found in other Western nations. In France, the relatively polite face, and I want to emphasize these are my words, in France, the relatively polite face of anti-immigrant racist sentiment is the very strong National Front Party run by the Le Pen family that tends to pull conservatives further towards the anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim right, also anti-black and anti-anything else that's not considered traditionally French. Ironically, both the Hebdo cartoons strengthen this movement and the brutes who massacred people in the Charlie Hebdo offices and elsewhere. Trying to achieve a better understanding between ethnic and religious groups and trying to better integrate Muslims and other groups into French society would weaken the National Front, weaken Charlie Hebdo, and weaken Islamic fanatics. One of the writers who refused to be at the PEN Gala, Francine Prose, said, I have been deeply shocked to read and hear some critics say that the position I have taken, along with other writers, amounts to an endorsement of terrorism. Nothing could be further from the truth. But I also don't feel that it is the mission of PEN to fight the war on terrorism. That is the role of our government. Our job in presenting an award is to honor writers and journalists who are saying things that need to be said, who are working actively to tell us the truth about the world in which we live. That is important work that requires perseverance and courage. And this is not quite the same as drawing crude caricatures and mocking religion. The bitterness and rage of the criticism that we have received points out how difficult people find it to think with any clarity on these issues and how easy it has been for the media and our culture to fan the flames of prejudice against Islam. As a result, many innocent Muslims have been tarred with the brush of Islamic extremism. The narrative of the Charlie Hebdo murders, white Europeans killed in their offices by Muslim extremists, is one that feeds neatly into the cultural prejudices that have allowed our government to make so many disastrous mistakes in the Middle East. And the idea that one is either for us or against us in such matters not only precludes rational and careful thinking, but also has a chilling effect on the exercise of our right to free expression and free speech that all of us and all the people at PEN are working so tirelessly to guarantee. And I guess that is a problem by people saying that they're horrified that people would not fully support Charlie Hebdo to the point of giving it awards. People who support free speech are actually trying to suppress free speech of other people. Let me read from an article in the Canadian, this is an Associated Press article. Michael Ondaatje, Francine Prose, who I just read from, and at least four other writers have withdrawn from next month's PEN American Center Gala, citing objections to the literary and human rights organization's honoring of the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. The writers were upset by Charlie Hebdo's portrayals of Muslims and the disenfranchised generally. The Paris-based magazine, where 12 people were killed in a January attack at its offices, is to receive a Freedom of Expression Courage Award at the May 5th event in Manhattan. Much of the literary community rallied behind Charlie Hebdo after the shootings, but some have expressed unhappiness with its scathing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and other Muslims. I was upset as soon as I heard about the award, Prose said. She said she was in favor of freedom of speech without limitations and that she deplored the January shootings, but added that giving an award signified admiration and respect for the honoree's work. I couldn't imagine being in the audience when they have a standing ovation for Charlie Hebdo. Other hosts who decided not to attend were Teju Cole, Rachel Kushner, Taiye Selassie, and Peter Carey. We do not believe that any of us must endorse the contents of Charlie Hebdo's cartoons in order to affirm the principles for which they stand. More recent, and also as a result of this, there were some comments from Glenn Greenwald as well. And apologies, while I will find those comments and read them for you in a few minutes. Sorry about this. Anyway, I will try to find those comments from Glenn Greenwald. But let's move on to vaccines. Now, you can talk about vaccines from a medical point of view or from many other different perspectives, but you have to have the right to talk about it. And what I've observed this year, since the start of the so-called measles epidemic in Disneyland, there has been a quick and rapid shutdown of any ability to have free speech in the area of vaccinations, anything that's critical of vaccinations. If you want to talk about how vaccinations are the greatest advance in public health, how wonderful they are, if you want to discuss the possibility that there should be mandatory vaccination, no problem at all. But if you want to say, well, it seems like we're vaccinating too much, that not all vaccines that we're getting are necessary, then you have gone too far, and that is not allowed to be said. There was recently a very good interview with Robert Kennedy, who has been an activist against mercury for many years, and through his interest in mercury, got interested in the issue of thimerosal, which is considerable quantity ethyl mercury. This was on HBO with Bill Maher, and it was actually a good interview, and Bill Maher challenged Robert Kennedy on a number of points. An article in the Daily Beast afterwards was quite shocked because they interpreted Maher as being anti-vaccine and therefore not an unbiased journalist. But it seems to me that journalists can be virulently pro-vaccine and nobody has any complaints at all. It seems like we're getting back into the area, if you're not with us, you're against us. So you don't have to be somebody who says that no vaccines are useful. You don't have to even be against any particular single vaccine. You might just want, like Robert Kennedy, you might just want one ingredient, mercury, to be removed from vaccines. And once that's done, you would be just fine with it. But you're not allowed to say that. What I have observed is that the MMR vaccine, which is measles, mumps, rubella, has become a poster child for the pro-vaccine crowd. This is a bit strange because measles, mumps, and rubella are not the most deadly of diseases among those for which a vaccine is on the market. The HPV vaccine supposedly protects against cervical cancer, which is a deadly disease. The polio vaccine is supposed to protect against lifetime paralysis. So although the consequences of having measles, mumps, and rubella are often emphasized, actually, in well-nourished people, the consequences are minimal. When I was a child in the late 1950s, early 1960s, everybody got measles and rubella and probably mumps, And I recently discussed this with my mother. I wasn't too aware of what was going on at the time. I was so young. But she said that she had no knowledge of anybody in her circle of friends having anything more serious than a fever and spots due to those diseases or swollen glands with the mumps. But now measles is talked about as if it was deadly, so deadly in the case of the Disneyland epidemic that nobody died. I would like to read a little bit from the label from Merck for the MMR vaccine. The ingredients in the MMR vaccine include chicken embryo cell culture, human diploid lung fibroblasts, buffered salt solution containing vitamins and amino acids and supplemented with fetal bovine serum, sucrose, phosphate, glutamate, and recombinant human albumin, neomycin, which is an antibiotic that in 2005 and 2006 was the fifth most prevalent allergen in patch test results, sorbitol, and hydrolyzed gelatin stabilizer. So that's it's notable that MMR does not contain mercury, and I don't believe that it contains aluminum like many other vaccines do contain. But it still contains a variety of ingredients, and you'd only have to be allergic to one of those ingredients to have a nasty reaction. As far as the efficacy goes, clinical studies of 285 triple seronegative children, that is children who previously did not have antibodies to measles, mumps, or rubella, these children were 11 months to 7 years of age, demonstrated that a single injection induced the antibodies to measles in 95%, mumps in 96%, and rubella in 99%. However, a small percentage, 1 to 5%, failed to seroconvert after the primary dose, and now they're recommending 2 or 3 doses, which is interesting because if you actually have the natural measles, for example, that is supposed to be lifetime immunity, and you never need to be vaccinated, and you will never get measles again. Some of the warnings are that women of childbearing age should be advised not to become pregnant for 3 months after vaccination. Postpubertal females should be informed of the frequent occurrence of generally self-limited arthralgia or arthritis beginning 2 weeks after vaccination. That's muscle pain. The vaccine is contraindicated to people who have hypersensitivity to any component of the vaccine, including gelatin. Do not give the vaccine to pregnant females. Anaphylactic or anaphylactoid reactions to neomycin may occur. Febrile respiratory illness or other active febrile infections. Febrile means with a fever. Patients receiving immunosuppressive therapy should not receive it. Individuals with blood dyscrasias, leukemia, lymphomas of any type, or other malignant neoplasms involving the bone marrow or lymphatic systems should not get it. People with primary or acquired immunodeficiency, people with a history of cerebral injury or a family history of convulsions or other conditions in which stress due to fever should be avoided. People should not have it if they have an egg allergy or within 3 months of a blood transfusion. Excretion of small amounts of the live attenuated rubella virus from the nose or throat has occurred in the majority of susceptible individuals 7 to 28 days after vaccination. It then goes on to say that vaccination with MMR2 may not result in protection in 100% of people receiving the vaccine. Adverse reactions include a huge number of disorders. I'll read a few of them. Atypical measles, that means that the vaccine can actually cause measles, which is what it's trying to avoid. Fever, headache, dizziness, malaise, irritability, vasculitis, swollen lymph glands, just let me say that. Anaphylaxis, which is very serious allergic reaction. Edema, that's the swelling of various parts of the body, which can be deadly. If it goes too far, it can stop you from being able to breathe. Arthritis, muscle pain, encephalitis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is basically polio, it's paralysis, convulsions, with or without a fever, meningitis, pneumonia, sore throat, cough, Stevens-Johnson syndrome. This is incredibly serious disorder. This is where your skin dies and basically rots off your body, and it's very commonly fatal. Stevens-Johnson syndrome is essentially was unknown before people invented pharmaceutical compounds. That is, there's no natural occurrence of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. It's an illness that is essentially limited to the modern era, the modern pharmaceutical era. Rash, again, rashes can be quite serious, and, of course, serious rashes can lead to Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Deafness, problems with the eyes. Finally, deaths from various, and in some cases unknown causes, has been reported rarely following vaccination with the MMR vaccine. So there really are genuine side effects and limitations of this vaccine that are admitted by the manufacturer of the vaccine. But what we get instead is that recently, within only a few days, a new paper came out entitled "Autism Occurrence by MMR Vaccine Status Among U.S. Children with Older Siblings with and Without Autism." And basically, the media response to this article is like, okay, guys, here's a paper that proves MMR doesn't cause autism. Case closed. Go home. STFU. You know, it's over. Except it doesn't answer the question. Nobody can answer the question of what would cause a massive rise in a disease, autism, starting a few decades ago as a virtually unknown condition, to now about 1 in 50 children. And has anybody actually had a good look at the study? It's been pointed out that the study is not really a normal group of scientists. It comes from an inside-the-beltway group, somewhat like the RAND Corporation, known as the Lewin Group. It's very close to the U.S. government. Now, an organization like that gets all its money from writing reports from the U.S. government knows what the U.S. government wants, which in this case is to prove that vaccines don't cause autism. So it's not exactly an unbiased group of scientists. It's way too close to the U.S. government. There were some socioeconomic problems with this study. By that, I mean that the people in the study were more white and more wealthy than the average, and much less black than the U.S. population. 30% of the people in this study came from families that had family incomes over $100,000. The number of black people in the study were 4% versus about 14% for the U.S. population. Everybody in the study had both medical and pharmacy coverage, which clearly doesn't represent the average American, where many people are underinsured or uninsured. In this study, almost nobody had a sub-high school education, 1% of this population versus about 10% of the American population. Also interesting, at the higher end, fewer people had a bachelor's degree. There's 24% of the families in this study had somebody with a bachelor's degree versus 34% of the general population. It's kind of a strange study format. So instead of looking in their database of this was an insurance company's database. Instead of looking in the database to see who got vaccinated and what percentage claimed autism following the vaccination, they looked only at children who had an older sibling who was also in the database. And they don't really describe why they would choose this slightly weird format. One of the possibilities could be that the group did many, many analyses and kept looking for one that showed no correlation between their study children and autism. And so this might have been one of the ideas that they came up with, and they hit pay dirt and came up with no connection. One of the first things that it says in the study is actually quite troublesome. The first sentence of the results in the abstract are, over 95,000 children with older siblings who were in the study, just over 1% were diagnosed with autism, and 1,929, 2%, had an older sibling with autism. Now, 2% is approximately the rate of autism in America at present. So if you randomly picked children who had an older sibling, you would expect 2% of those older siblings to have autism. But what you wouldn't expect is that only 1% of the younger siblings had autism. This is not really discussed in the paper, but what it could mean is that parents who are enthusiastically pro-vaccine because they've received so much pro-vaccine propaganda as they were growing up thoroughly immunized their first child, but then maybe they have a bad experience with a vaccine. Maybe their child has some episodes of seizures or is just clearly ill for several days afterwards. Maybe it doesn't rise to the level of autism, but it could be that parents are less likely to vaccinate later children because of bad experiences. But you can't really tell anything from this study because it only studies one vaccine, the MMR vaccine, which does not contain the mercury or aluminum that many people believe are troublesome components. That's not to say that there aren't things in MMR that can cause problems, but two of the most worrisome substances that are in many vaccines are not present in the MMR vaccine. So you really can't tell from this what was the lifetime exposure of the children in the study to all vaccines. All they want to talk about is MMR. It's also a little bit, it appears a little bit contradictory that amongst the children who did have an older sibling with autism, there was a much higher rate of autism in the younger children. And this is also a little bit mysterious. If autism is truly a random bolt of lightning that comes out of the sky, as has nothing to do with the fact that you've been vaccinated, then younger children shouldn't have a greater risk of autism if they have an older sibling with autism. So I need to explain this a little bit, because they just said that of the younger children, 1% were diagnosed with autism, whereas 2% of the older siblings, and yet I'm now saying that about 5% of the children who had an older sibling with autism had autism themselves, which is much higher than that 1%. The answer to that is that for the children who had an older sibling without autism, the risk of autism was lower than 1%. This possibly could be because the parents deferred other vaccines other than the MMR vaccine, even though most of this group of children were fully vaccinated for MMR. We don't know anything about their other vaccines. So we cannot really say from this that the MMR vaccine is for or against autism, because it has to be taken in the context of all of the vaccines, not just did these children get fully vaccinated with everything, but were they vaccinated according to the schedule, or did the parents, having seen some bad reactions when possibly their children got two or three vaccines on one day, decide that from now on they're going to give one vaccine at a time, see what happens, and if everything's okay, go back for other vaccines rather than just saying, well, let's go to the doctor and get it all over with at once. They may see the problem with this. Recently, I wrote to a local magazine known as Alberta Views. Alberta is a province of Canada that I live in, that in late last year had an issue with the headline article, Should We Have Mandatory Vaccination? They had a little article on polio, which in Alberta, like most other parts of North America, was a big problem in the 1950s. They state that the worst recorded polio epidemic in Alberta's history started in the summer of 1952, but became particularly widespread and deadly in the summer of 1953. And they say, fortunately, in 1953 to 54, Dr. Jonas Salk developed an effective polio vaccine. In 1962, an oral polio vaccine developed by Dr. Albert Sabin became widely available. The number of polio cases dropped dramatically. This is an example of what they've said is kind of true, but it's also kind of false. Now, it is true that in Canada, it appears that the biggest polio epidemic was in 1953, and in the United States, it was 1952. But 52 and 53 were both bad years for polio. It's also true that the polio vaccine was trialed in 1954, but what is left out is that even by 1960, both in Canada and the United States, less than 50% of the vulnerable population had been vaccinated, and so one would have not expected a dramatic decline in the rate of polio. And yet what happened in both Canada and the United States is that in 1954, 55, 56, 57, there was a dramatic drop in the number of cases of polio. Then there was a slight rise in around 1958 and 59, and then a drop again. And this all occurred well before the so-called herd immunity had been achieved, when over 90% of people are vaccinated is when it's believed that herd immunity will occur. So I wrote a letter to the magazine, which of course was not published, partly because it was too long to be a letter, and even if they had wanted, even if they had considered having it as an article, they wouldn't, because it was considered as anti-vaccine, and you're just not allowed to talk about anti-vaccine. So this is what I wrote. As a left-leaning, science-oriented progressive, I cringe whenever vaccination is mentioned because I know its opponents will be portrayed as anti-science, ignorant, internet surfing, crazy, self-centered, fundamentalist, religious, right-wing, uncaring libertarians. And I was sadly not surprised by the dogmatically pro-vaccine views in the November 2014 issue of that promoted mandatory vaccinations and dismissed critics. Quote, the anti-vaccine movement thrives, as does all pseudoscience, on the irrational dressed up in a lab coat. Ironically, like most pro-vaccination articles, there was not a whiff of actual science, just claims that the truth is obvious to anybody with faith in scientists and MDs. In contrast, I know that there are mainstream doctors and scientists who are opposed to vaccination, not just Andrew Wakefield, who I believe has been used as a whipping boy to stop discussions of adverse reactions to vaccines. I recently interviewed Suzanne Humphreys, MD, and that's an interview on the infectious myths, which I hope you'll listen to if you haven't already. Suzanne Humphreys is an otherwise mainstream kidney specialist who became concerned about vaccination when she noticed that the only unusual thing in the history of some of her emergency patients with otherwise unexplained kidney problems was a recent vaccination, and I think she mentioned the flu vaccine, which contains mercury, and mercury is toxic to the kidneys. She did an enormous amount of scientific and historical research and eventually completely reversed her position and concluded that most, if not all, vaccinations were misdirected and dangerous. The scope of her research is well illustrated in her book, Dissolving Illusions. I've read mainstream scientific articles that document recent measles epidemics in mainly vaccinated populations. I have heard that the early promises that one measles shot would eliminate the need to get the disease to gain immunity, those promises proved false, and that now two shots are necessary, and even then protection is not complete. I've also seen the statistics that show that most infectious diseases were on a rapid decline of cases of severe illness and of deaths before vaccination became available, but that vaccine advocates like to start their graphs around the time that the vaccine first became available, distorting history. I'm aware of the controversy that erupted when a prominent CDC researcher recently published on his lawyer's website an admission that he had helped hide an association between autism and the MMR vaccine. Now, if I can take a little diversion here, CDC researcher, Thompson, had found a way with the other researchers to eliminate poor black children. Now, what's notable about this new MMR paper that came out is there was a very low number of black children in the study versus the actual U.S. population. And so any study that can eliminate black children, which have a lower income than the rest of the American population, anything like that is going to help hide the association with autism. So to continue with my letter, I've read the Nobel citation for Harald Zurhausen, discoverer of HPV, which admits that it will be decades before we know whether the HPV vaccine reduces the risk of cervical cancer. Yet progressives and others with faith in science act as if none of this evidence, and there's a lot more, they act as if none of this exists. They act as if the pharmaceutical giants that produce most vaccines act only in the public interest and have never been caught acting unethically in pursuit of ever bigger profits. Perhaps the problem is faith. Faith in an institution science that is far from perfect and that is often corrupted by the desire for monetary gain, status, and simple survival in the publish or perish world of big science. Apart from these carrots, there is also a very real stick among scientists, the fear that taking a contrary position, even on a small proportion of the vaccine question, can destroy the career, reputation, and livelihood of a scientist or doctor. Faith in science is, in fact, a contradiction, because scientific viewpoints can only be attained by critical study or research, not by putting those with the job title of science or MD on a pedestal. Put mathematically, faith multiplied by science equals faith, not science. What is interesting about the November issue of Alberta Views is that the reprinted Red Deer Express article on polio, which I quoted from earlier, does not support the benefits of vaccination. This is important because the success of the polio vaccine is something that is deeply embedded in our consciousness as a flawless and complete success. But the effectiveness is, in fact, a myth. The polio vaccine field trial occurred in 1954, and the reprinted article correctly notes that the worst epidemics were 52 and 53. The field trial itself could not have made any differences because the total number of people vaccinated in the trial was only about 500,000, mainly in the United States. An interesting historical note is that Alberta was included in the field trial of the polio vaccine, but the data was not included in the final summary statistics for reasons that are not very clear in the report. Perhaps the exclusion was due to the fact that the number of cases of polio in vaccinated children in all the participating areas of Canada was 3, the exact same number as in children receiving placebo. Even the success of the field trial, the polio vaccine field trial, based solely on U.S. data, is questionable. There were 33 paralytic polio cases amongst those who were fully vaccinated and 110 among those who received placebo. This sounds good, but spoiling the picture were 124 paralytic cases classified as other, which included children who were never vaccinated or more importantly, who did not get the complete series of 3 shots. The authors did not reveal how many of these 124 cases were in the vaccination arm versus the placebo arm. So if all 124 of the cases were in partially vaccinated children, then the number of paralytic cases amongst those who received some vaccine would be greater. And the precautionary principle would say that in that case, the vaccine should never have been approved. There is the distinct possibility that there was no benefit or even increased risk of polio with vaccination. All polio cases should have been grouped with their treatment arm. If there were more polio cases in children with one or two but not three vaccines than in children with one or two placebo injections, this indicates that the vaccine may have been causing paralysis. It certainly cannot be concluded from the study that the vaccine completely prevented polio, and this was not even claimed by the official report on the trial. In the United States, where the best statistics are available, the epidemic peaked in 1952 at 37 cases per 100,000 and declined to 23 in 1953 and 24 in 1954. The major drop occurred a year before the vaccine trial even started. Even by 1960, as I've mentioned, only about half the population was vaccinated. And cases did start to increase again in British Columbia, where vaccination started in 1955, as in many places. Cases dropped from 480 in 1954 to only 12 by 1958, but then increased again to 165 in 1960 before dropping dramatically again. Another study, Canada-wide, also included an epidemic in 1959, the highest incidence of polio since the pre-vaccination epidemic of 1953, even though close to half of the Canadians under 40 had been vaccinated by that time. If vaccination caused the 1955 to 57 decline, what caused the later rise? If vaccination didn't cause the drop after 1954, what other factors were there? What did cause the epidemic of the early 1950s, which in the United States had more than five times the number of cases in most years since the 1920s and more than double the number of cases of the second worst epidemic from the mid-1930s? For an explanation, we need to go back to the observations of the Red Deer Express. It notes that polio really took off in the West at the beginning of the 20th century. Actually, it was late 1800s. This was about the time that the use of pesticides also took off, chemicals that can cause paralysis. Prior to World War II, these chemicals were largely based on arsenic, although other neurotoxic metals such as lead were sometimes included. One of the very common pesticides had the name Paris Green, and I believe the green came from the inclusion of arsenic. Pinning the blame for polio on pesticides would be wild and crazy speculation if it was not for another important, though not completely accurate, observation of the Red Deer Express article, that the autumn was the time of the worst epidemics. Polio epidemics did not correlate precisely with the autumn, but they correlated precisely with the fruit harvest season. This seasonality of polio is one of its most remarkable features, a feature that is still impossible for virologists to explain. A scientific paper in 1933 showed a strong seasonality in most countries' studies, with a dramatic increase in polio cases during the harvest season, August, September, and sometimes October, except in the southern hemisphere, where the harvest season is in our spring. A paper by Gebhardt in 1946 graphed data for several U.S. states and matched the harvest of fruits from strawberries in the early summer through apples in the autumn with a similar extraordinary increase in polio cases. Utah in 1943 had less than 10 cases each month from January through July, but 43 in August, 211 in September, and 82 in October. New York had under 10 cases January through May, but peaked at 300 in September. California had under 50 cases January through May, but peaked at 590 in September. In the first half of the 20th century, nobody thought or perhaps dared to blame pesticides, even though arsenic is a known neurotoxin. Following World War II, it fell out of favor as the world fell madly in love with the chemicals known as organochlorines, especially DDT. In this era, DDT was even available in paint or underwear. Its health and environmental consequences were not widely known. When polio erupted in the early 1950s, people were fixated on viruses, and only one or two scientists, now almost forgotten, thought about pesticides. This talk about polio would appear to vaccine proponents to be a moot point, because we all know that polio has been almost eradicated from the earth, and what can we take credit for that for but the vaccine? But what is not so simple, because the number of But it is not so simple because the number of polio cases in the world, according to WHO statistics, is either hovering above zero or rapidly increasing, depending on how you define polio. If you define polio as paralysis with the presence of the polio virus in a stool sample, then yes, the virus has almost disappeared. But if you define polio as paralytic symptoms in a young person without any other explanation, then who calls it acute flaccid paralysis, AFP, and is happy to report that cases increased from 2,377 in 1996 to over 100,000 globally in each of the years 2011, 12, and 13. They are happy because they believe that acute flaccid paralysis has always been with us, and the increase in reported numbers reflects better surveillance, not a real increase in cases. Why does nobody care about 100,000 annual cases of unexplained paralysis and their causes, which even the World Health Organization admits includes pesticides? Vaccine proponents display their ignorance when they celebrate the elimination of polio and decline to talk about acute flaccid paralysis, which is the disease polio. Surely the disease is more important than the virus, and clearly the virus is at best only a minor cause of polio disease today, and possibly was falsely accused in the first place. The question in this magazine, Alberta Views, was not whether vaccination is safe and effective, but whether it should be mandatory. But the viewpoint that vaccines are so close to perfectly safe and so close to perfectly effective is based on a system that has evolved in which everyone, including doctors and scientists, is reluctant to question any aspect of vaccines for fear that parents may stop vaccinating their kids. The parents are mostly caring and intelligent people. If there are some vaccines for which the disease is mild, such as measles and chickenpox, I think parents are smart enough to balance the small risk of serious disease against the small risk of serious adverse events. And if the effectiveness of a vaccine is exaggerated, of course the cost-benefit ratio changes in favor of not vaccinating. Vaccination should not be an all-or-nothing proposition. It should be a matter of an informed decision for each and every vaccine, including evidence on its effectiveness at preventing disease, the rate of adverse events, and the severity of the illness that it prevents. And I think all that intelligent people, including listeners to this show, want is to have freedom of speech on vaccines. And I hope that the information that I have given you in this episode of The Infectious Myth will help you think a little bit more about vaccination and also about free speech in general. Thank you for listening to another episode, and goodbye.